This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
People, you know, were commemorating and celebrating, you know, what had happened 10 years ago, because, you know, there are a lot of answers that are still needed from really what happened there 10 years ago. So the open line yesterday was dominated by the issue of marijuana. And today I thought, well, let's bring somebody that I actually saw in about 2014, 2015. I actually, you know, saw the person. I didn't know the person, but the person was speaking at something called where, you know, journalists get together and other stakeholders get together. It was called The Gathering. And it was a Daily Maverick event. And this individual has or was speaking on the issue of marijuana at that particular time. And I remember standing there, or sitting rather, in one of those seats. And I was thinking, you know, one day, Denzel Taylor, when you have a show of your own, one day, Denzel Taylor, if ever possible, you know, this is somebody you need to absolutely engage with. Because as I said earlier too, when I started the show, somebody who was really, really passionate about what was happening at marijuana and really, really passionate about the widows, you know, who were going through the worst at that particular time. Because remember, the widows were sleeping, you know, at the Farlam Commission all over, and they were visiting, and they had come from all over the country, you know, and there was this symbolism of all these widows in blankets listening at the Farlam Commission. And there's a whole, you know, question mark around the Farlam Commission as well that I want to put to my next guest. Well, but yesterday marked a decade since 34 Lonmin mine workers were killed when police opened fire during a wage strike. And for most of the families, the trauma of August 2012 has had a psychological and emotional impact. 10 people, including Lonmin mine security guards and police officers, died in the days leading to the massacre. We are joined by the executive director of the Socioeconomic Rights Institute, SERI, Nomzamo Zondo, who spoke at a marijuana commemorative event titled Respect and Retrospect, hosted by the University of Johannesburg's Center for Social Change, and said that immediate and extended families had lost breadwinners. Well, my guest, of course, is Nomzamo Zondo, and I'm going to bring her into the conversation. Nomzamo, it's an absolute pleasure to be talking to you tonight. Welcome to Power Perspective.
Thank you so much for having me, Denzel, and for reminding me of that conversation at the gathering.
Absolutely. You know, I stood there in awe and I looked at you, and you had so much detail and you spoke with so much passion. And I you know what happened yesterday? I actually said to my producer, to Mello, I said, you know what? There is a person that I remember from about 6-7 years ago. I don't know her name. I can't remember her name. All I know is she was either working for an NGO, but she has a legal mind and she was representing families. Let us find her. And, you know, later today, when by the time we phoned you, we had found you. Thank you so much for joining.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure, Tumel. Sorry, it's a pleasure, Denzel. And it's thanks to Tumel for finding me. Yeah. I didn't know it was such a hassle.
No. Well, it was a hassle because I couldn't remember the name. I couldn't remember the name. And I should have remembered the name, Nomzamo. But here's my question to you, Nomzamo. From that particular point that I would have seen you there and where you were already engrossed in this marijuana issue. You've been with this issue basically from word go, you know. Immediately after things began to happen, your interest was sparked. You began to take on, you know, a certain cause. Has this particular story been one of the most traumatic, dramatic, emotional for you?
Denzel, also, it's very hard to speak about marijuana. So I've been working for SERI for 9 years. It'll be 10 years in February 2023. In all that time, I worked on the case of the Marikana of the Marikana families, initially in the commission, and then in the last 7 years, in trying to pursue both civil and criminal accountability for them. I think as someone who's highly spiritual, I think it would have been very difficult for me to only engage this issue intellectually. It has been a very emotional issue. In fact, I've struggled with the fact that I'm someone who always centers her clients. Yes, I'm a lawyer, but I believe that it is my clients who must be seen, my clients must be understood. And I have in thinking about it the last few days of like we're in this moment where it's been 10 years since the massacre, I've not really kind of processed what that means for me emotionally. A few tears were shed in the last 2 days, just thinking about how difficult the journey has been. But I think it's been most difficult exactly because it's been difficult for the victims, right? And even though we accompanied them, being able to look back and think of the harshest moments, the moments where we completely lost hope. And if I think specifically to one of them, it was the day that the commission's report was released. And in my mind, there was this a Xhosa hymn, which says, "Zod is it gabeke zonke." So when everything is finished, God will have the last word. And in that moment, that hymn kind of held us together as legal representatives and as a family, as we kind of thought like of how do we have a report that has this type of outcome. In the report, for instance, despite a proposal that the issue of compensation must be addressed, it wasn't addressed. In relation to the criminal prosecutions, the commission kind of said someone else must now go on and investigate. And it kind of felt like a moment where 2 years had been lost and we couldn't really see much value in it. I think, of course, having moved on from that moment now, we do see that we actually have justice because of and in spite of the commission. Because in the commission, we're able to get all the evidence that could point to who the people that are responsible for the massacre. It is in the commission that, for instance, the National Prosecuting Authority and the team is able to find a place where all the evidence is, where they can now start looking and say, who must we hold accountable? It is also in the very same commission that the families attempted to kind of show how the massacre and the days before affected them. And it's really looking back in the commission that we're actually also able to say we have actually traveled very far. The fact that you can invite me to this show, and of course there will be callers who will call and say, but 10 people died before the 34 were killed. But many others in South Africa understand how important it is for us as a country to hold our government accountable for the fact that 37 people died in a matter of 4 days through guns that were issued by us and authorized by us as South African citizens.
Absolutely. And also instruments of the state, really.
Exactly. And that is power that is given by us. The police are given the power of violence by us, but that power is supposed to be exercised in a specific way. And the fact that they use that power to kill these mine workers who are really, I mean, in the last few days, for instance, someone was reminding me that of the 37 miners killed by the police, 29 of them are from a specific part of the Eastern Cape. They are in the part of the Eastern Cape that falls between Butterworth and the KZN border. And that is the rural Eastern Cape, one of the most poorest, in fact, the poorest province in this country. And to have those miners killed by the police while fighting for a living wage is really disappointing. And it really, I think for many people, it really got us questioning whether we are living in a democracy, whether actually there's a line that we crossed on the 27th of April, 1994, or whether we're still stuck in the past. And not only that moment of the actual guns, but every day that's moved past then. I mean, in the people that talk about the 10 people that died before the massacre, those people would be surprised to learn that those, at least seven of those people approached the president in 2018 and asked for compensation.
Yeah, I want to touch on those. I want to touch on those points as well. And as you unpack them, I actually want to deal with them thoroughly. So before you get there, You would have spent a lot of time with the widows, and I do remember, you know, sending journalists to cover the Farlam Commission now, which sat for almost 3 years, right? And these people have had to wait. As you say, there is now a place where all of this detail, all of this evidence is. That Farlam Commission sat for 3 years. In essence, that also took away from the lives of these people that were just waiting, in essence, to find out what happened. In your space where you would have sat down with widows who were asking you for justice, who were asking and looking at you to bring them justice and or to mediate and or find them relief, just or unpack their emotions even, specifically widows and traveling so far, not having any hope in hell that, you know, something will be done because it's them against the state, it's them against a commission. What disempowered you, what empowered you when you engaged these women who were themselves now looking for help and powerless themselves?
Look, the organization that I work for, which had, by the time I joined this case, been working with the victims for over 4 months, has a very specific ethos. An ethos that says it is the victims of all the ugliness that we see, of inequality, of poverty, who know how to fight it, right? And so when I arrived at Seri, already they'd gone to all these different places, not only the Royal Eastern Cape, but Lesotho and Swaziland and some other parts of this country, and had gotten and gone to the family and saying, what do you want? What does justice look like for you? And at the very top of that, it was like, we just want to know. We just want to know why it happened. And then outside of knowing what happened, we want to know what happened. So that ethos that Seri holds was very important for me. And I think it was very important even in my formative years as a young lawyer coming into the public interest sector. That was one thing. But secondly, I am someone who's very spiritual. So I think I have to own the fact that it really helped me to be able to look to God in the moments that were truly heartbreaking. To be able to say, there's a place where I can go and cry and say, but why is this happening? Or why is this happening in this way? And then another thing that is very important is how, despite me and the other members of the legal team having legal expertise, the families have their own naturally born sense of justice, to the extent that in 2013, July, they left the commission. And they left the commission in July 2013 because the minors were not being funded to participate in the commission. And the widows, despite our advice and despite our viewpoint, said to us, we were not at that mountain. We don't know what happened. The only people that marched along our husbands, that marched along our brothers, marched along our sons, are the people that are now not being enabled to participate in this commission. If they won't be part of this commission, they won't give this commission legitimacy. And they walked out. And it took maybe, I think, about over 2 months for the miners to be funded and for them to return to the commission. And when they returned to the commission, the families came back. So it was humbling, of course, to think like you're a lawyer, you've studied, but you have these people who are set in their own ways and who have such clarity about what should be done in every moment, despite their level of education, despite how they are feeling. Because in that first year that I worked on this case, the families were still traumatized. And of course, in the commission, there would be evidence that is also further traumatizing. But even at that moment, they always had clarity of purpose, and they always knew what to do. And I remember now in this moment that there were wise old men in the men that were with us, but there were also very wise young widows who said, "No, I will speak up, even in this moment, even though I'm still in my mourning clothes. I will speak up because this is my husband's life, this is my husband's legacy, and I'm not going to miss the moment to make an impact." And I think that guided me.
Sure. Nomzamo, did they find justice at the Farlam Commission? Because I'm going to put a couple of things to you. There's been a lot of criticism. I watched it over time because this was an international story, actually. It involved, you know, people who were going to become president of this country eventually. And I mean, gruesome as it was, and there's contestation at the a particular point whether to call it, you know, a massacre and or not. And I know that ANC people and government will turn away from that particular wording, calling it a massacre. But I want to ask you this: was there justice for them at the Falun Commission? Because some of the findings read like this: that the tragic events that occurred during the period 12 to 16 August 2012 originated from the decision and conduct of the strikers in embarking on an unprotected strike and in enforcing the strike by violence and intimidation using dangerous weapons for the purpose. That puts the blame fairly and squarely on the mine workers for the initiation and everything that developed there during that period. So I'm asking you, and in the Falun Commission then, in a general, having just looked at that that little paragraph that I read you, did they receive justice there? And I know you speak of the Falun Commission as to say, yes, there is a positive note. All the information at least now sits there. We can go now and source it. And then, you know, if there's a criminal or civil litigation case, well, we can go there and find that information. But for the people that were impacted, did they find justice?
Definitely not. I mean, I think if we look at that moment, that's why I said that moment was one of those most heartbreaking moments for us. Mm. And that quote that you quote comes from chapter 3 of the report. Mm. But if you go towards the end of the report, you find a similar quote. Mm. So as the report starts and as the report closes, the massacre is really put on the shoulders of the miners. And so it kind of continues the narrative that we had about why this happened. And but it takes away from, so one of the things that is important, at least for me, is that you would need to know who died, right? Mm. You would need to know the injuries that they had when they died. Mm. And then you'd need to know who those people were and then who was affected by their death. Mm. And if you go to the commission's report, you might be able to find the names of all 44 people who died, mm-hmm. right? But you will not be able to find for all 44 of them how they died. Mm. And this is a very important information for us, because when you went and looked at the number of wounds, I believe that Mtsweni Noki, who's sort of seen as a person who symbolizes the massacre, he had 23 wounds. Mm.
Is that the green blanket?
Yes, the guy in the green blanket. Mm. 23 gunshot wounds when he died. Mm. And I think one or two of those are to his head. Mm. Right? So that the person who went to view his body would have been traumatized just from that experience. And that's not in the report. Two, in the report, you don't get to know that who Mambush was. That Mambush, by the time that he came to work at the mine, he was an orphan. Mm. That he supported not only his wife and his five kids, but he supported his sister and a niece who had herself been orphaned. Mm. You don't get to know that he was a soccer player. You don't get to know that amongst the leaders of the strikers, you have Xolani Nzuza, who was the manager of the soccer team that Mambush and people like Mzokolo were part of. That's not in the commission's report. In fact, and even if you go and search for different people, so I mean, the evidence leaders kind of took Ntate Andres Nsinyeho from Sasolburg as a person who kind of tells a story of why the police went overboard in their claim of self defense, and they said, but look at Andres Nsinyeho. You can see him in the video. He's wearing a yellow backpack, and you see him from when they're coming down the mountain. You see him as they go around the crowd, and you see him throughout here. He's wearing a yellow backpack. Doesn't have a weapon on him, but he is killed on that day, right? You will not find those details, even though they're in the evidence leader's heads of argument in the commission's report. Mm. But what and even worse, you will not find any details about the people that were in Nsinyeho's life and who he left behind. That's not in the commission's report, even though the commission, at the end of the day, is motivated by the loss of those lives.
Sure.
The one thing that's that was difficult for us in my first year, like working in this case, I had come back from working in an insurance company. I had been dealing with claims of motor vehicle accidents. So I was kind of like used this kind of environment. And I come to the commission and our clients are fighting to say, We want to be able to tell this commission who our loved ones were and how their losses affected our lives.
Mm.
It took months because the police were fighting that application. In fighting the application, the police were taking, were objecting to our clients saying that the police killed their loved ones. Mm. When there was no dispute about that, but there was no other way. It was the police who were shooting. This was captured on film.
Mm.
It took months. But at the end of those months, when the commission finally gave the go-ahead, they agreed that the families could give this evidence, but they would give it on a day the commission would not ordinarily sit, and that it would be optional for those, for the legal representatives to attend, except except the police department and the and the evidence leaders, which mm. meant that the evidence of how the death impacted the victims was mm. not important enough to be heard by all the other parties.
Mm. James Nicol. Yes, I wanted to just put this point to you. James Nicol, I think he represented some of the families at the Falun Commission.
No, he worked with us. He was part of our team.
He describes the commission as the most hostile commission for working class and ordinary people I've ever been involved in.
And I think that sums it up, right? Mm. I think when our clients participate in the commission, there were times, and I remember this because my colleague recalls it in a film that Seri eventually produced about how the widows would cry, right? Because mm. there would be a video, and the widows would cry, and then Falun would say, "If you know you can't take it, go outside," right? If you can go back and check for the cross examination of Mzokolo Makidiwana, who was 23 at the time of the massacre, right?
Mm.
He's 23 years old. He comes to the commission, and he is badgered
mm.
by Vuyani Ngwalana SC, and in cross examination, the point that he breaks down multiple times, and he needs to go into counseling. In that process, the commission doesn't protect Mzokolo. But at the end of it, the commission doesn't even understand, doesn't even read Mzokolo's evidence
mm.
in line with who he is. Mzokolo is a young man from Elliotdale, a Xhosa in the Eastern Cape. If he sees a stun grenade, to him it's a bomb.
Mm.
But the commission then calls him a liar because it says no bombs were thrown from helicopters.
Mm.
But the evidence is people are throwing stun grenades from helicopters. And in fact, even if you go technically,
mm.
a stun grenade is developed as a bomb, but
mm.
a bomb with less effect. But the commission kind of says, but there were no bombs, because it's treating Mzokolo as someone who's like a legal representative in the commission,
as an expert,
as an expert, and forgetting who he is and his life experience.
Mm.
So I think just that process, the process of sitting in the commission, from how our clients were treated, and even on this point of the fact that when the commission finalized its report, it did not include their lives in it,
mm.
even though they fought to have legal aid pay for their legal representation. They fought to the Department of Justice ensure that they are accommodated and get to attend the commission. The commission didn't really value their participation and did not, in the end, include their life stories in its report.
Yes, we're unpacking Marikana. It is 26 minutes to the top of the hour. I'm going immediately to go to Pat in Marikana. Pat?
Evening.
Hi, Pat.
How are you?
I'm good, man. How are you, Pat?
I'm good.
Sure.
I'm currently an employee in the mine.
Sure.
And then,
wait, Pat, just repeat that. You're currently an employee in the mine.
Yes.
Sure.
And then this massacre that happened, we have a colleague that we lost in our operation.
Sure.
And then we're not talking about that.
Sure.
That this thing or this whole massacre, it's in two ways.
Mm.
And looking, we're always one-sided. That's my view. That's what I see now.
Mm.
We, as an employee, obviously, this starts from the internal on the workshop or in the mines underground.
Mm.
We every year we have an annual, increment that we expect.
Mm.
And then we will say, this is what we are tabling on a table as an employee.
Mm.
Question two, our representative, which is our union.
Mm.
Then we said, okay, we want this so much. And then the union will go on the table on behalf of the employee.
Mm.
Then, to cut the long story short, then that happens, And then there was an employee who said, okay, let's negotiate while we are working.
Mm.
And some said, no, we are shutting down because the employee, they don't listen if you don't shut down.
Mm.
Which they took the other road. And there's a, I can say 40% of other employees, they were saying, we want to go to work because we've got kids, we've got a stallmates and all the stuff. And there was a tribe, I won't say the name, that was insisting that, no, we will stop you guys to go to work. And there's people who lost their lives because of that issue, that people were taking, like, if me as a pet, I'm willing to go to work, I'll hide myself and go in a taxi. They'll stop the taxi and they take you out of the band. So I'm talking that because I've got a colleague that I lost. He was banned in a taxi by our own brothers, our own guys, whom they are taking their names now, whoever now. They kill our own brothers. So we ourselves, we have made this problem ourselves as an employee before, even we talk about the police, the government, internal. And that thing is still there even today. When we are sitting in a meeting, when we say we're having, right now I'm from work now, I'm from the shutdown now. I knock off now, I'm going off now. Like enough, I'm an artisan, I'm able to buy a car. There's guys who don't buy a car now in the mine because of their salaries. But what I'm trying to say is that let's not be one-sided. We as employees, we cause these things to happen.
Sure. Pat, thank you so much for that. Nomzam, I'm bringing you back into the conversation. Nomzam, I want to, because that's where the conversation goes to next, in essence. Having unpacked, you know, some of the issues just on the Farlam Commission, one of the questions I had, and it's earmarked here for you, is people falling between the cracks and families just, you know, either not finding legal representation or not being compensated. And I'm not even with the question around compensation yet. I'm going to get to that particular period. My question to you is, based on also what Pat is saying, are there people who fell between the cracks who either, you know, were found to be not compensated, and or the grouping that died, you know, before in the run-up, where they are not spoken about as much as, you know, the shooting of the day? How do you look at that particular narrative and that particular, you know, argument that's put in front of one, where you say, you know what, when we do commemorate Marikana, for example, we tend to forget?
Sure. So, Denzel, last week, say we had an event. At the event that we had, we invited 44 families. We act for 36 of the 37 that were killed by the police.
Yes.
So it means that in the 44 that we're inviting, we're inviting the seven that were not killed by the police. And as he said, so if you look at the at what happens at the strike starts, the strikers go to the LPD. After the strikers go to the LPD, they are told that they must go and speak to their union. When they go to speak to their union, their union is informed by lawman security that the strikers are coming to attack you. At the time, the strikers had been sent by lawmen to go to their union. I had been told that we won't talk to you, we'll talk to your union. And so they were going to their union to say, look, we went to go talk to the employer. The employer is insisting on you. Please tell the employer to engage us. Because at the end of the day, it's our salaries, it's our lives. Right? And what then happens is that when the miners get there, the strikers get there, they are shot at by NUM representatives. They are trade union. And I want people, because there's always this confusion about, so what was happening at the time of the strike? All the RTOs said, we're going to take the trade unions out of this. So people who that I even knew who were in the commission had been members of Solidarity. They'd be members of NUM. They'd be members of AMCU, right? But so, and when this shooting happens, right, it forces people to then arm themselves, because then they're like, okay, we went to our trade union peacefully, but we were sent back with guns. Two people are injured, but there's a rumor that spread that those people had been killed. And so people then go home that night thinking, tomorrow, whatever happens, in fact, there's even evidence of a storekeeper who says, on this day, all of a sudden, my shop was swamped. I sold every possible thing that looked like a weapon that I had in my shop, because people felt like I must arm myself, because now I will have to. I might be faced by danger, and that's when the situation changes in the strike. And I want to say in the narration of the strike, right, there is the recognition of the two security guards who who then die the next day, being the 12th of August. And this, in these two security guards, people have to accept that they are killed in a situation where there were a lot of strikers. They were shooting at those strikers, supposedly they'd been instructed by their employer. Seeing a crowd, hundreds of strikers, and told that you must stop these strikers. They started shooting at those strikers with rubber bullets. And at the end of that process, they were killed. Yes, right, and brutally so, painfully so. The kind of killing that any mother, any wife, any child, right, would be heartbroken about. But the situation they were put in, by their employer, right, because they shouldn't have been sent there. Just that, I think it was like two or three vehicles, but it's actually one vehicle in the end that where these two security guards end up dying. Beyond those two security guards, there are three non-striking mine workers, right? And we have to, and so the only thing I want to finish is that in relation to these two security guards, even though they were killed in a crowd, right? People must accept that it's not everyone in that crowd who killed them. At most, let's say it's possible that at most maybe there's 20 people who are involved. And the question goes back again to why then, because of those 20 people or those 10 people or those 5 people, do we then say all of the miners are killers and all of the miners deserve the death that comes to them 4 days later?
Do I hear you
after
saying
that?
Sure, carry on.
No, you can ask your question.
Do I hear you saying that Lonmin pushed for the workers to go to work and put workers by doing that in harm's way?
That's definitely one point that I'm making. But secondly, these two security guards were on duty.
Yes.
They were sent to stop a group of strikers who were just marching, right? So they were, they were outnumbered, and in them being outnumbered, they used rubber bullets, right? So they shot into the crowd to stop the crowd, but they were outnumbered by so far that could just made the situation more explosive.
What if any then responsibility do unions have? We talk about the police, we talk about the president, we talk about the government, we talk about, you know, the minister on the day, the minister of police, I think it was Natiem Tetwe. We talk about the police commissioner at this point, because eventually she's also fired. What if any responsibility do the unions have here to this particular narrative?
So there's two things, right? So as I've said earlier, Noom started the violence. Before the Noom shooting of workers on the 11th of August, there was no violence. And Noom must take responsibility for that. And I might be misremembering, but I remember when we were still in Rustenburg, and Senzeni Zokwana, who was the Secretary General of Noom then, saying in the commission that he had addressed a Noom general meeting. And he had said in that meeting that Noom had become a pig that eats its own children, because he knew that it was those actions, right, that kind of made everything worse. But beyond that day of that specific incident, and of course they'd been given the wrong information, they'd been told that people are coming to attack you, and they'd armed themselves in to respond or to repel an attack. And that's its own problem, again, which is Lonmin's responsibility. Beyond that, there was a responsibility on Noom and AMCU and the trade unions that were active at Lonmin at the time, right, to engage the workers and to facilitate engagement between Lonmin and the workers. These workers had been specific. They were saying, we've had Noom as our trade union, right? We've had trade unions, but we have not been heard. As a result, we are putting unions aside so that we can speak directly to the employer. It was a responsibility of both trade unions to go to the employer and say, please speak to these workers. The employer refused to do that. And we're still Noom, despite initially having gone to go and speak to the workers, decided that it's not going to get involved. And in fact, has been on the side of the narrative that even doesn't acknowledge the massacre.
Sure.
Right? And AMCU, despite this, I cannot forget the words of Joseph Matunjwa on that day before the massacre happened, where he says to the mine workers, please leave this mountain, please go home, because these people will kill you and they will employ other people and pay them money that cannot do anything in a black person's life. Those are the words of Joseph Matundra within about in the hour before the miners are killed. And when he when they tell him that, no, we'll think about it, go. And when they tell him that, won't attack the police, don't worry, just go. We're not, we're just here waiting for our employer. We're going to continue waiting. He still, when, and as he goes to his car, he remembers to come back and say, please, from what I'm seeing out there, your lives are in danger. You need to come down to the mountain. And in fact, it is that plea that, that the miners listen to, and they decide to leave the mountain. And it is when they leave the mountain for, after responding to Matulwa's plea, that instead of the police allowing them to follow the route that they'd followed for every day since the strike started, well, since they moved to the mountain, instead the police shoot at them as they go towards that route.
Nomzamo, sure, let's move on a little bit, and I want to talk about accountability here too, because I've started the conversation already with the unions. Presidential accountability at the time, and non-presidential accountability at the time. So, when I say presidential accountability at the time, I don't mean the president who was, you know, sitting at the time. I'm talking about someone like Cyril Ramaphosa. So, you have been instructed. This I'm aware of. You were instructed by your clients to write to the president to say, at least, you know. Because implicated and had a role to play, that's how we understand it. And you've written to him for an apology, which I believe you never got a response back from, and that correspondence is still there. And all basically you were saying was, these people, these families need a name, they need a place, and they need a time for you to arrive whereby you can engage them, right? Have you ever received any other communication from the president, now sitting president, Cyril Ramaphosa, in response to, I'm assuming, a legal document that you would have sent him to say, these who are my clients are requesting that all you do is you give them an apology?
So, interestingly, Denzel, we are instructed to write this letter because of news reports of a public debate that the president was speaking in. I believe he was at Rhodes at the time. And while he's at Rhodes, he says, I want to apologize to the families. I intend to apologize to the families. And this, of course, is carried by most of the news media.
And he actually promises to go.
Yes, and he promises to go.
And I think he promises also to take Ma Winnie Mandela with him.
Exactly.
Yes.
So our clients say to us, look, the president can't announce that he intends to apologize to us on a public stage somewhere. He must come to us. He must come to us. He must be in one room with us. In fact, we're not interested in having the media there, but he must come and look us eye to eye and apologize to us. And so we write to him and we say, look, the family, in fact, what we're saying is, the families heard what you said in Grahamstown. The families are waiting. Tell us the date and the time and the place.
Is it a legal document, or is it a request from,
It was a letter from our office written as the legal representatives of the family. And the letter was acknowledged by the presidency. So we it's not even that we can say they never received it. They received because they acknowledged it. But then beyond that, there was never a response. There was never a response to say, we'll come on this day. There was never a response to say, these are the challenges that we have with coming, or even to say, what would be acceptable to your clients on the apology. And I can maybe just, I can tell your listeners here, our clients said what they would want is they would want that apology to happen in a place where it's not only the widows who are there, that the elders from their different families are there. That it is an intimate setting, as I said, where the presidency can just say to them without even cameras, what they can say to them with sincerity, I'm sorry that this happened to you. It should never have happened to you. And this is very important because when the strike starts, the first communication from the president to someone in his company, Umvela Panda is in his company. He says that it makes sense to him while the rock drill operators are on strike, because they are the least paid of the rock drill operators in the platinum industry. And it makes sense to him. So it's sad, and because in that moment, when you read that correspondence says that he understands while the workers are on strike, and it makes sense that they deserve more than what they are currently getting.
Mm.
And in that moment, there was a possibility that he would have facilitated the conversation between Lonmin and the employees. There's a possibility that as a shareholder, he could have said to the directors, actually, should you not be engaging with these workers, exactly because you know that Implants is now paying their rock drill operators 9,900 rand a month, and ours are only earning about 4,000 rand. Should you not be talking to them and trying to find a solution? And he didn't do that. And even now, when they've now made this request, say, okay, we hear you want to apologize, we are ready. He hasn't even bothered to say, okay, I'll come. Then I won't go to the Eastern Cape. I won't go to Lesotho, but I want to meet with you, with each family representative in Marikana, in Rustenburg, and give this apology. He hasn't done that.
Is it the same that would account to Sibanye as well, which was Lonmin at the time? That you would have written to them, and I'm not sure whether you've written to them. I'm aware pretty much that you would have written to the presidency, that they never responded in the way that you would have wanted them to respond, apart from acknowledging the documentation. Sibanye now, but Lonmin then, would they also, you know, have been asked to, in some form or other, recognize what happened and an apology of some sorts?
So it's very interesting, right? Because in the commission, Lonmin says that it is also a victim that its staff were killed in this massacre. Mm. But the interesting thing is that our clients, and in fact all 44 families, have a direct relationship with Sibanye. They meet with them more than twice a year. In fact, tomorrow they will be with them in an annual gathering that Sibanye holds.
Mm.
And in one of those gatherings in 2020, Sibanye started what they called its Marikana renewal process.
Mm.
And in that gathering, Sibanye said it wants to ensure that there's healing for the families. And it made them some promises that it has now not kept. But the families have continued to hold them to account in relation to that.
Mm.
That's one side of it. The second side, which is problematic, is in relation to the miners that survived the massacre. So Sibanye and Lonmin, right, have been very quick to kind of acknowledge the losses suffered by the families. They've responded by starting the 1608 Trust to ensure the education of their children. But they haven't acknowledged that there are miners who survived the massacre. They haven't acknowledged that there's those who were seriously injured in the massacre. And even when Sibanye took over from Lonmin, there wasn't a serious acceptance that there is another stakeholder that you need to engage in relation to the massacre. And if you have to engage all of your staff, because there's a big part of them, well, there's over 10% of them that are part of the strike.
Mm.
But then there's also a specific group of over 300 workers who were either arrested and accused of the murder of the 34, or they were seriously injured. And that group they don't engage with. And that group then took Sibanye and President Ramaphosa to court.
Mm.
And when they took them to court, they've sued Ramaphosa, Sibanye, and the state for 1 billion, but they also asked one for an apology, and they asked for the establishment of a monument.
Mm.
Both Sibanye and President Ramaphosa have opposed, right, these two requests: the request for an apology, the request for a monument.
Mm.
And specifically, in the argument is that you are not legally entitled to that apology. Number one, but two, they're saying the monument is even worse. There's no way, no one has ever been forced to erect a monument as a relief that's coming out of a legal process. And the miners are saying, but this is a different circumstance.
Mm.
Here, people lost their lives, people lost their limbs, and you were implicated in that loss, and you must do this. And Sibanye, I promise you, is willing to pay for and arrange for a monument, but it wants to do it out of its own free will.
Sure.
It does not want to do it because they have to do it. And so it's like, on the one hand, they're busy engaging the families and the widows about this monument. Mm. On the other hand, they're in court arguing that the miners are not entitled to ask them to have that monument, to make that monument.
Am I correct then, and just correct me if this is my takeaway, that both the president and Sibanye are saying the miners are not entitled legally and or other than to an apology. Basically, you're not entitled to one.
Yes, exactly.
Wow. Okay, I have to ask you this question then. Would an apology... Let me play devil's advocate with you, right?
Mm.
And you're a legal mind, so you'll be able to tell me exactly. I'm going to play devil's advocate with you. If you would write to the president and ask him for an apology, or even if you didn't write to the president and ask him for an apology, if they asked him generally for an apology and he gave one, right? Would that not open him up to that 1 billion rand civil case that's happening at the moment already, whereby he would then be in a weaker legal stance should he in some form or another? And I'm not saying the apology is to accept responsibility, but it could be seen to be that from a legal perspective. And so he's caught between a rock and a hard place, that if he dare, and this might be what his legal people are telling him, that if he dare apologize or should apologize, these are the legal aspects that will then follow.
Look, so there's two things, right? And you're right. In the litigation for the apology, President Ramaphosa is the case is against him as an individual,
sure.
Right? Not as the president of the country.
Yes.
And he has to make those decisions. So as Sir Ramaphosa, an individual, possibly there is the argument that says if you apologize in any way, right? I can see a lawyer somewhere saying, if you apologize in any way, you'll undermine your defense in this case. And I can see why a lawyer would feel that's necessary.
Mm. But I mean, me as a general, you know, just citizen, I look at it and I would think, well, maybe that's the reasoning, you know, and I don't even have to be a lawyer to start looking at it that way.
Sure. So there's a challenge here, right? Because at the end of the day, he's a politician, right? We have to trust that he'll always act in the public interest and not in his individual interest. And if we cannot, if he is unwilling, right, to apologize to people who have lost their loved ones, in instances where he was involved, and in instances where he even intervened, right? Where he intervened, and the outcome resulted in death, then we have a right to not trust him as a politician. So morally, there's an obligation on him as an individual. Like I'm just now addressing him as an individual. If he wants our trust that he can govern this country in our interest, then he must be able to address the issue of Marikana politically, right, and saying, I have to acknowledge my role, yes, even if I don't think I caused the deaths, but I was there. I missed an opportunity to bring these two people together. And when I missed that opportunity, the end result was scarier than any of us could have imagined, and it left this dark mark on our democracy. That's one thing. That's him as an individual. But on the other side, he's also the president of this country. Right? When no one denies that every one of those 37 people, their lives were taken by the South African Police Service, were in fact taken by the South African government. In what world can he say, I refuse to apologize for that? And that is not only to him as the current president, it's also to Jacob Zuma, who was the president when the massacre happened. Because that apology was due the moment those lives were lost. in 2012, and for the years thereafter, even as in 2015 when President Zuma released the report, he was the president. Even when he released the report, that apology was due. He didn't give it. But still, Ramaphosa is now the president. He can give that apology. He can say, as the South African, as the person who is the highest person holding the highest position. In South African government, I want to give this apology to you. This should have never have happened.
Sure.
And I also want to assure you now beyond, so you can talk to the families, and then they can talk to us, me and you as members of the public, and say to us, I want to assure you that this will never happen again. But unfortunately, because the apology is not coming, because many other things have not happened, we don't have that one assurance. So last night I was at an event that was hosted by the Forge, and Sibulai Diaw, whose father was killed at Sin 2, who was one of those miners who was hunted down after he survived the first killing, who was hunted down and murdered in Sin 2, addressed the crowd. And he said, for him, every time he sees a policeman, he sees a murderer. And he says it's not just simply a generalization. It's because he doesn't know who are the 700 police officers who at Marikana. But most importantly, of those 700 police officers, those who did not kill have not brought forth the evidence of who did commit those murders. Because for him, for as long as he doesn't know who killed his father, he's entitled to assume that every police officer that he meets on the road had a hand in his father's death. Sure. And this is a thing about when you look at SAPS and the Marikana moment, is that in the Marikana moment, we have this picture of SAPS as people who could attack us at any moment. It is important for the police officers who have integrity, right, to say, not in my name.
Sure.
This was done by people who were wearing the same uniform as me, but this is not what this uniform means. Because this is not what this uniform means, I am here to support you, and I'm here to give the evidence that I know.
I am in conversation, and I have been in conversation with just over the last hour with Nomzamo Zondo, the executive director of the Socioeconomic Rights Institute. And I did tell you, I gave you the historical background as why I thought she'd be the perfect person to actually have this engagement with. Well, we're going to go back to her in a second. Teboho has been holding on for a while. Teboho, Mabopane Teboho, how are you?
Hey, I'm fine. I will be fine one day. let me just say this. Let me just start by saying it's such a interesting to hear somebody who's actually has got such a informed position to actually help us with some of the frustrations and some of the allegations that we're hearing on the radio. Let me start by saying that I would like to hear from her side. The statement that I actually said yesterday, that the former CFO of Lonmin uttered on BBC, and then the very same statement that he said in his own word, that what is happening in Lonmin is criminal activities, and then concomitant actions must be taken, and the South African government must see to it that they address those issues. So in a way, he was giving instructions to a political favor, positioned person who actually was in having some shares in his company, which is Lonmin.
Teboho, I'm going to leave it there, Teboho, because I have to move on. Teboho, Mandla?
Hi, good evening. How are you?
I'm good, Mandla.
I just want to send a quick question, ask a quick question.
Sure, Mandla.
To the lady there at the studio.
Sure.
I just want to understand, what is the rationale around not including the president of that time and the Minister of Police into the papers of the court in terms of suing them? Because surely surely workers were not massacred by the private security force, which is controlled by white monopoly capital, in which the President Ramaphosa then was speaking, but it was massacred by South African police force, which is authorized and controlled by Nathi Mthethwa, a minister then, and maybe as it was authorized by Jacob Zuma. Surely Jacob Zuma, see people need massacred on CV for the first time in the society. He knew about it as a president.
Sure. Mandla, I'm going to leave you there. I'm going to bring Nomzamo back into the conversation. Nomzamo, I think you've dealt with some of the aspects. Maybe touch on them again from the two questions that were raised here.
Sure. I mean, I'll start at the last one. So
sure.
both the families and the minors have instituted litigation against the Ministry of Police.
Mm.
And it is the Minister of Police, for instance, the families asked in the litigation for the apology.
Yes.
It is the Ministry of the Police and SAP specifically that has paid the damages that have been paid. I think at this point it's about 175 million rand. That has been paid 104 million to the arrested mine workers,
mm-hmm.
and 71 million, actually 70, sorry, now the numbers, I'm losing the numbers, over 70 million, just under 80 million paid to the families.
Mm.
And so that definitely, I think that part is handled. And I think the families have never dealt differently. And I think even the miners never dealt differently with President Ramaphosa and President Zuma, sorry.
Mm.
And for instance, the report was released because the miners took President Zuma to court, forcing him to release the report. And at that time, because we had hopes at that time, the report would provide a lot more than it did.
Mm.
And then in relation to the question about Ramaphosa, I think that's the one thing, right, and I think the miners have been saying this much louder. In fact, some of them have even said they're even willing to spend some of their compensation towards making sure that he's prosecuted, because they were out on strike, right?
Mm.
While they were out on strike, there are incidents, and I'm sorry, when I was giving the breakdown, I didn't finish and explain. So I explained deaths. I didn't explain the other five deaths, which are the deaths of. On the 13th of August, mine workers had gone to one of the shafts. When they'd gotten to that shaft, and they'd gone there to say, "You must tell whoever is here who's working that they must stop working because we are all on strike."
Mm.
And the security guards told them that we will tell them to stop working. And they left the shaft and walked back, and they were going back to the copy. And while they were walking, they were stopped by the police. After the police had been informed by Lomé Security that there's a group of mine workers who are walking on the railway next to the railway line. When the police saw them, they engaged the police, and the police said they want their weapons. And they explained to John Bebe that, you know what, we have been attacked. In days before, just 2 days ago, we had gone to Noom and we were attacked. We cannot give you our weapons. But if you take us to the Kopi where the rest of us are, we are happy to give you our weapons there. And General Bembe received a phone call. After he received that phone call, his demeanor changed, and he said, "I'm going to count to 10, and you either give me your weapons and or there's problems." And while he's counting, the miners start walking to their destination. And while they are doing this, the police, Bembe gives an instruction for the police to follow them, to escort them.
Mm.
And so the police are escorting them. But all of a sudden, there's an instruction given. In the criminal case that's before the Northwest High Court, there's been evidence that it was General Bembe who gave this instruction, that they must throw stun grenades, tear gas, right, and use rubber bullets on this crowd. This crowd at that moment had not hurt anyone, was simply running towards where they said they were going, which was the cop. And stun grenades are thrown, tear gas is thrown. In fact, the tear gas canister goes first, and then there's stun grenades, and then immediately there's chaos. In that chaos, almost immediately, there are three people who die, right? Two policemen, Warrant Officer CAC Hendrik Monene and Warrant Officer Selo Ronnie Lipago. And then there's also a mine worker who dies there. Semi Joganis. After that, another mine worker, and then the police after this pursue the miners, right? They pursue the miners, and in that, another mine worker, a sucking mine worker, Tembelake Mati, is killed. And after he is shot, he tries to continue running. Other mine workers try to help him, but then he eventually stops. He runs close to someone's shack. And then dies outside that shack. Another miner who probably believes that he's escaped, it is over 200 meters away from where the initial clash happens. And that Phumzile Sokanyile, he is shot by people who are more than 80 meters away from him.
Mm.
And there's an allegation that there are five policemen who are charged in the same case which Jordan Mbembe is charged. And those five police are charged with having killed this man, having assassinated him when he was running away.
Mm.
And those are the deaths that happened on the 13th of August.
And this information is at the Northwest High Court, where some police officers are coming, well, came forward to talk about their own colleagues and own up. And other than that, we would never have, you know, really got any other information about what was really going on, you know, with the police service. Because if my recollection is right, we never even saw them at the Falun Commission.
No. I mean, some of them gave evidence in the commission.
Yeah.
But the ones, for instance, that give specific evidence around Mr. Sokanyile's death did not give evidence in the commission. And more importantly, one of the biggest complaints about the commission is that the people who shot at miners at scene one, who shot at miners at scene two, only two shooters gave evidence in the commission.
Sure.
The rest didn't. And the concern is then there hasn't been a place where those people have accounted or at least justified why they discharged their weapons.
Sure.
And even worse, in the situation where now people have been killed, we don't really have an idea, at least so that even when we hear the police's claim that this was self-defense, to understand what was the mindset of each individual police officer, especially in instances where there isn't a single police officer that has a laceration, a scratch from the 16th of August.
Sure.
I
need to also have kept you for a very long time, and we've asked you politely to stay on, and you've nicely agreed. To round up the conversation, I want to put it to you this way. Some of the agreements that were made between the mine and the families was that some of the children, or if they were old enough, and or the women, could take up the positions of, you know, positions that would have been occupied by their husbands, and maybe not directly the same positions because of the gender, you know, arrangement. But they were then offered employment in the mines, at Lonmin in particular. So. I look at that particular aspect, and I look at the issue of gender-based violence. You are looking at a company that would have, in some way, resulted in your husband's or loved one's death. And you are now engaging in that relationship with that company. I know because there is a need, and because, you know, South Africa is what South Africa is, and so people would take up those positions, but otherwise I would have thought they would have run, you know, like, you know, that, because it's the last place you really want to be.
Exactly.
It's like asking the woman who has been beaten up by her husband to go back, you know, and live in the same house, you know, where the beating happened.
So I mean, the widows always speak about the trauma, right? So some of them, in fact, some of them did become miners, right? So they did go underground.
Mm.
Some of the widows, and one of those widows is Mampeti Kadler, and she always said that every time she would get inside the lift, how she would have that picture, like, and her thing would be, if only people would understand, right? What it takes to mine, the fact that you would get on that lift, and then at times you have to walk 15 kilometers to where you'd actually start working once you're underground. And so the interesting thing is that the request, so the families asked Lonmin for them to be reemployed.
Okay.
So some of the work that I did, and I found my colleagues doing it, Seri, when I got there, people like Osman Ngomazo, is that we were begging social development to give the families food parcel because they didn't have food. Mm. And one of the things that the families also, and coming to the commission made things even more complicated, because while their kids not really have food at home, they were sitting in the commission, would have lunch prepared by the commission, would then have breakfast at a hotel, have dinner at a hotel every night.
Mm.
And they would say, like, how guilty they feel having three meals a day, right? Three decadent meals a day, when they knew that there's nothing at home. And that's why in 2014, they wrote to Lawnmen. In fact, initially they'd asked us, and we were trying to dissuade them. And they even wrote to Lawnmen and said, you know, Lawnmen, you know our workers. Our workers are, you know, they're an NGO. They have nothing. And that's why we haven't asked them to direct this, but we are writing this letter ourselves to you. We know that you have a policy, because the mines had a policy, that when you, if you, for instance, if you get sick or if you die while you work in the mine, that a family member will be able to replace you. And they said, we want you to, you know, to
and use these were the economic pressures.
Exactly, at that time. But at that time, then Lawnmen only replace, only give jobs to 34 families that were employed by them. The other three, they refuse. And they refuse because, so that them, that Telejana had been employed by Shark Stickers, which had work outsourced to them by Lawnmen. So they said it's got nothing to do with them. One of the people killed was someone who was a job seeker who had gone to bring lunch to his uncle. So they said we have nothing to do with him. And then another miner, Toby Limpumza, had been dismissed at Lawnmen a year before. And at that time there was an ongoing labor case between AMCO and Lawnmen for their reemployment. In fact, the group that he was part of was reemployed in 2014. And Lawnmen says we won't reemploy them. I promise you, we went to extreme lengths to convince Lawnmen to even get those three families jobs. Jim Nichols, who you spoke about earlier, even had a meeting with Ben Magara in London to say, but the plight of these three families is the same as the rest. They need this job so that they can also have a monthly income. But the widows have said, and even yesterday at the commemoration, this was repeated to Sibanye, to say, Sibanye, as you say, could solve all of this. They could make sure that each of the 44 families have an income, right, every month. They could make sure that the salary they're paying now, they send every month without demanding labor for it. And we just have to look back to the time when those miners were alive, and the huge profits that Lawnmen made off their backs. If they just simply sent them home and sent that money to them every month, I promise you they will never have to go into their own pockets.
Sure.
They would still be going into the profits that they had because of those deceased mine workers.
Nomzamo, what does for the people of Marikana, what does justice look like to you?
We represent the families and the miners, but there's a question about what about what's happening in the communities. I mean, the one thing that's always been like strange for me is if you go to Nganeng, people live in shacks without windows, right? They have limited access to water. Electricity is another thing. The access to basic services. And Sibanye's position at least has changed in the last few years, and they've said they intend to upgrade the Nganeng informal settlement. And the only understanding between that upgrade is a land swap between them and the Mapoba Mogale, who own the land. And that's really important. Like, we need it doesn't make sense for people to live on the richest land and live the most poorest lives. It's important that the lives of the people who live in Marikana look like the platinum that lives the mine in trucks every day. And that will be justice, number one. But two, I think for the families, for the miners, I think even the community, there needs to be an annual recognition of this massacre through a public holiday. It shouldn't be negotiable. It should not have the South Africans should not have to swap May Day for Marikana Day. I think the South African government knows it killed 34 people on the 16th of August. It knows that there were other 10 other people that died in the week before. It knows that it was its role and how it engaged with Lawnmen in the process of that week that led us to that outcome. And it must then at least give all of us a moment to reflect on that through a public holiday. And if that is on the 16th of August, it should be. I don't see why it should not be. Three, you know, people in terms of international human rights law, they need to repair, right? And one, apart from just guaranteeing and repetition through the public holiday, through changing policing in South Africa, they also need to make sure that there's compensation, that those who are responsible account. And that's important. If we can have that, I think we can kind of have hope that actually we are living in a democracy, that this was a mistake, that this was a tragedy, as you would say, as the ANC would say, as Noom would say, as many other people might say, if it was a mistake or a tragedy, then it at least requires a response to a tragedy and a mistake.
Nomzamo, before I let you go, Raputi wants to ask you a question. Raputi?
Good evening.
Sure.
Denzel and going to a guest.
Sure, Raputi.
Now I'm asking, what about those 10 guests? Did you not, those 10 victims did not commit suicide. They were killed by striking miners. And then nobody is telling Matuya to pay reparations to their families.
Sure. Raputi, I'm going to end it there just because of time, and I think she has answered that question. Nomzamo, it's a combined question of what the unions should be held accountable for, and, you know, speaking to, you know, the people killed before. But, you know, in about a second or in like in a minute, you want to sum that up, because I do have one last question for you.
Sure. And I've broken it down. Mm. 5 of those 10 are killed in effect by the police. In fact, right now, the National Prosecuting Authority has charged 6 policemen for 5 of those deaths. So then we have 5 deaths left, right? And for those 5 deaths, we want the police to investigate. We want the police to charge people that are responsible. We want the police to report to the victims. Mm. They must report to Mrs. Fundi. They must go report to Mrs. Mabelane. They must go report to Mrs. Mabibi. And the NPA must engage those families about what are they doing about prosecuting whoever is responsible for those killings.
Sure.
And again, as I said, in relation to the unions, I promise you, and yes, I might be saying this as someone who was once the attorney for AMCU, but really, Joseph Matundwa did his best in that week to bring everyone to the table to stop bloodshed. I think of all the people that were there, he did his best. I really don't think that he should be carried to do anything. In fact, I think I think Miner Shot Down captures the role that Matundwa played, from the phone calls that he made, from the meetings that he had, from the pleas to workers, to even telling the police that he will go and speak to the miners against their advice, because the police felt that he was unsafe, and he said, no, I want to go and speak to them. So I really feel like Joseph Matundwa can't be blamed for what happened that week. And again, also be clear to say, the strike at the end of the day was a strike where the workers said, we don't want our unions involved here, because we want to speak with one collective voice as mine workers.
Nomzamo, you started the conversation saying God will have the last word. And do you believe God will have the last word?
I do. I have to. I think that's the most important thing. I have to. The families have to. The miners have to. And when I say the families, I mean all 44 families. And then I also mean the other families that lost lives after the massacre. In the days that the strike continues, the families that have lost people, even in the last 10 years, God has to have the last word.
Nomzamo Zondo, thank you so much for coming here onto Power 98.7 and just dissecting this conversation for us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Denzel. Bye.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.